You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. So if you need batteries for your truck, batteries for your trail cameras, TV remote controls, flashlights, you name it, Interstate Batteries has what you need. They have thousands of retail locations all over the United States. So stop in, talk to a battery specialist, or for more information, visit interstatebatteries.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys, I'm going to kick this podcast off with just kind of brace yourself. This is something that, once again, we're going to dive deep into the bushes of land management, but specifically for the wild turkey. We have Mr. Dr. Mike Chamberlain here to discuss a seminar that Matt and I set in yesterday.
Yep.
Welcome back to the NWTF show. You hear the guy on the intercom. But we're going to talk to him about his seminar yesterday and all his research that he's got going on in the Southeast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's exciting for us. We've been following your Turkey Tip Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And on social media.
So basically, if you guys want to learn those, we're gonna start sharing them on our Facebook page if you're good with it.
Absolutely.
So people can start digesting what it is, turkey management. Overall, I guess if we're gonna sum this up, there were the golden days. What everybody I grew up where it was like tons of turkeys in the Ozarks. But there's been a lot of people talking about the decline of turkey populations.
Yes.
And so we're sitting at the show. There's 50,000 plus people that walk through these doors, and they all go through the vendor booths, and they're picking out turkey calls, and all these people are talking turkey season. But if we don't have the research like you guys are doing to understand how to continue to improve habitat and find ways to make sure that we have populations of turkey, all the calling, all that stuff's going to end because we have
to.
It's all for naught.
We have to apply. There's got to be that research aspect, then the education, and the application.
Sure.
Of all this great information.
Yes.
I'm ready.
Yeah. Share. So let's hear kind of your going into your spill yesterday, focused on broods.
And a quick background of education, where you're at right now. As well, professionally.
Yeah, we just sat down and started recording.
My background?
Let's hear about you.
Just real quick. Yep.
Yeah, so I grew up in the suburbs of Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, no kidding.
Dirty
feet. I grew up in Stafford County.
Running around with a BB gun, chasing everything. Ended up at Virginia Tech as an undergrad. Got an opportunity to go to graduate school at Mississippi State and stayed there to study turkeys. And honestly, I was interested in turkeys, but not that much.
Right.
I was a deer guy and started working with this bird and became fascinated with their ecology and their management. Stayed on and did a PhD, and I've been studying turkeys ever since, so 25 years now.
Awesome.
Mm. Wow. So now you're stationed out of?
University of Georgia.
Okay.
I've been there for about 8 years.
Awesome.
In a daily daily basis, just conducting research, working with grad students to continue to learn population dynamics,
Absolutely.
Everything about a wild turkey.
Yeah, and my job depends on the support of state agencies that are willing and interested to fund research
sure.
on this bird because they recognize the relevance of this bird to their economic engine.
Absolutely.
So thankfully they contract me to hire grad students and do the type of work that you saw presented yesterday.
Yeah, so a little bit, going to try to stay focused here. My ADHD chasing squirrels and rabbit trails is going to be a little bit difficult because I've watched your posts for, I don't know, months now. And so it's like, ooh, I want to talk about predators. Ooh, I want to talk about your fire research. But today we're talking about your seminar yesterday.
Okay.
So give us kind of a introduction to what what research you discussed.
Yeah, so yesterday we discussed brood ecology in the southeast, and basically kind of the logic was we've seen this precipitous decline in poult per hen ratios. It's been ongoing for decades, kind of right under our nose, kind of smacked us in the face about 7 or 8 years ago that we've got a problem. We're now down around one poult per hen across most of the southeast now. That's not sustainable.
Right.
We came from about 3.5 poults per hen, if that gives you some perspective. So it's either and or poor nest success coupled with poor brood survival, we think.
Mm-hmm.
So we've already shown that nest success is quite a bit lower than it was years ago. And now we needed to talk about brood. So basically what we did was we marked over 400 birds. We ended up with about 100 broods that we tracked across a number of sites, all pine-dominated forest. And we ended up finding that two take-homes. One is only 7% of nests on the landscape produce a poult that survives to 28 days. If you think about that, that's
very scary.
The probability of one of those birds becoming that tom that you hunt or that hen that you see is really low.
Especially when you think about clutch size, 10, 12, maybe 15 eggs.
Right.
That's a lot that are dying.
The other big take home to me is that broods that move farther after they hatch die. So their survival is dramatically lower if they have to move a considerable distance during those first few days after they hatch. And that distance, as you may remember, was about 800 yards-ish.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, if you think about it, first few days, if they have to move more than about 1,000 yards from that nest site, chances are they're going to suffer mortality. And not just one poult, but the entire brood will be lost.
And I think it's important to discuss, why may they be moving? What are they seeking as soon as they're hatched? Go into that from just a life cycle standpoint of, you know, the growth rates that they need, and what are they seeking out specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, this bird, they're carnivores when they're hatched. I mean, really.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Yesterday you were referring to them as predators.
They are.
Typically when you say predator, you automatically think the coyote that everyone hates or the raccoon that everyone hates, but you're using it in a sense that a turkey is a predator.
When they hatch, they need insects. Yeah. And they're going to move to wherever those insects are available. And if they're not, they're going to keep moving. So our assumption is that these broods are moving longer distances because they have to. If they were encountering enough insects, they wouldn't move those distances. And if you look at the news, a lot of people don't pay attention to this, but there's been research showing global declines in insect abundance and diversity.
Sure. Yeah.
And that has to affect this bird. Has to.
Down the line, absolutely.
Now. It's happening.
Well, what I'm saying is like down the trophic line.
Exactly.
Right?
So this bird needs to eat constantly as they're growing. Every day they need to eat constantly. So if they're not eating constantly, then their growth rate is lower. And if their growth rate is lower, it's cumulative. You think about if they get behind day one, and then they get behind day two, and they get behind. It may only be a little bit behind, but by the time they're 28, they make it to 28 days, they may be a little smaller, they may be a little short, whatever. But the bottom line is that every day of that early life affects their lifetime fitness. It may just be a small effect. So it's a real cause for concern with us because broods, you know, it's hard enough to hatch.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, then if you get sucker punched after you're one of the 20% that actually hatch, if you get sucker punched and now you have to travel 1,000 yards, you know, to find foraging areas, then it indicates to me we have a habitat issue in the southeast. We're lacking brood cover, and the birds are showing us that.
I know a lot of your work obviously is located right there southeast, but this is something that's being seen in the northeast as well as probably the Midwest in some regions.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this isn't just a southeast issue. It's not just in a pine-dominated system.
Mm-mm.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, no, and I mentioned this yesterday that the same trends that I showed for the southeast are common across the east, northeast, and several states in the Midwest. They may not be as dramatic as what I showed in the southeast, but they're there. And this morning there was in the plenary session, we were discussing states that haven't gotten to the point where their birds have kind of reached a point where they're seeing declines, but they're going to.
Sure.
This is coming nationwide. This is going to happen because we don't manage landscapes like we did 25, 30, 40 years ago.
This year alone, Kansas has lowered the bag rate down to one bird.
Right.
On the eastern
side
of the state.
Yep.
And it's just, you hear this ongoing Arkansas people. Of course, we live in Missouri, so we hear a lot of Arkansas people griping about lower, and everyone has something to blame. But overall, what would you say is just the decline is just poor habitat?
I liken it to a death by a thousand cuts.
Okay.
You know, this bird, clearly, as I discussed yesterday, from a brood perspective, there isn't a habitat issue, but there are other habitat issues. This is a bird that requires a diversity of habitats in their annual cycle. They need hard mass during the winter.
Yep.
Well, what do we see happening to hardwood forests throughout the eastern U.S.? Mm. They're disappearing. They're being converted to other forest types. In the deep south, it's pine.
Yep.
And we don't see pine being used as brood habitat at all.
Yeah.
So you're seeing declines in the quality and maintenance of open habitats. We don't burn like, you know, as much as we used to. You don't see disking used like you used to. The disturbance regimes that we see now aren't what they were years ago. And you see broad expanses of the southeast and eastern United States that look the same.
Yeah.
From a structural standpoint, they just look the same to this bird.
Yep.
You have predation issues. You know, turkeys are dealing with predators now in a way that they've never had to deal with before. There's more of them. There's species like coyotes that we talked about, you know, that may not eat a lot of turkeys, but they certainly harass turkeys.
Yeah.
That has to have some consequence. Sure. We don't understand what it is.
Yeah.
So it really is death by a thousand cuts. We think, you know, there's some issues with how we might be harvesting this bird. You know, there's a lot of managers that feel like perhaps seasons are too early in some situations.
Right.
You know, your state went through regs changes trying to minimize the harvest of toms early in the season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kill one the first
more
week
breeders,
type. Yeah.
Right.
So there's a lot of grappling and talking amongst agencies because, in my opinion, we had a problem right under our nose, and because we were still harvesting a lot of turkeys, nobody paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, whoops, we need to do something. And
we need to backpedal a little bit.
Yeah, we need to back up and move forward. And I think that's what you're seeing with a lot of agencies now is they realize there's an issue. Hunters realize there's an issue. Not everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, some places have plenty of birds. And exactly what you just said, turkeys live in pockets. They live in these pockets on the landscape. And those pockets aren't all the same. You may have places that have a lot of turkeys and they're doing quite well, and then one county over you have turkeys that are in a different pocket, if you will, that aren't doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's land use changes, you know, predator communities that are kind of subtly changing across the landscape, you know, tack all that together and you have death by a thousand cuts.
So let's define, getting back into your seminar, let's define nesting cover. What would you define adequate or quality nesting cover?
Yeah, so we used, if you look in the science literature, it says, well, cover that a bird can hide in, basically. Anything 1 yard or less, grassy, shrubby, you know, down debris they can put their nest against. And what we see in reality is this bird will nest just about anywhere.
It's very similar to what Frank and Kyle discuss on the quail.
With
aspect.
Quail, yeah. I mean,
they'll nest in many different substrates.
Anything.
Yeah.
And we see no link, which is something that's going to be discussed in the session this afternoon, no link between vegetation and nest survival. We see zero.
Wow.
And the reason is this bird is plastic. They just nest, you know, they nest everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think there is a thing such as ideal nesting cover.
Gotcha.
I guess a lack of nesting cover.
Right.
At that point.
Right. I think the issue becomes that we've always looked at it like turkeys need to hide.
Yep.
Right. And the more I've thought about it in the past decade, the more I think we've looked at it incorrectly. Perhaps this bird needs to see. So think about understory in a forest and where they would nest. This bird makes a living by being able to use its eyes. That's its primary means of defense. Well, if a bird has to chock herself up in a dense stand of blackberry and sweet gum, she can't see.
Yeah.
So perhaps nesting cover for this bird should be viewed in that, can she hide and still see, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure.
So it needs to be, you know, knee high or something like that, to where if she senses something, she can stand up and go, oh, I'll use that periscope of a head and there's a bobcat coming.
Yeah.
And a lot of the nest sites that we see, that's not the case. And we see some really wonky nests sure. that are in places like, what in the world was she thinking doing that? And she hatches.
Yeah.
You know, and then we go to a place that I would look at and go, that's perfect. Like, that's beautiful. And it failed.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I don't personally think, and our data support this.
That.
I don't think there is an ideal nest.
Gotcha.
I think maybe we've looked at it.
And do you think that's because they just are very adaptive, or because, as we mentioned pre-show, that they're trying to spread out and not nest? You don't see a hen nesting right next to another hen.
Yeah, so what these birds do, and we're just – this has been known in the turkey world for a while, but it hasn't been really applied to nesting behavior. But so we know they have these dominance hierarchies, right? And we know that these hens that are together in the spring, one starts the breeding process. She breeds first. And then she goes to nest, and as she's going to nest, the other hens that are under her, like rungs in a ladder, they breed. So that's why you don't see all these birds go to nest at the same time.
Sure.
They're usually spread out for about a few days. So let's just say five hens are breeding with this one group of toms. Those five hens may start incubating across a 2-week period. So let's just say. Well, when they do that, they go space themselves in this area, so you don't have, unlike say with ducks, where you can literally kick up a duck feet from another nest, you don't see that with turkeys. We see them, if you look at their incubation ranges, they're exclusive of each other. They don't overlap at all, so they may end up recessing, you know, these breaks they take from the nest when they, you know, they go defecate and forage and relax dust. They may be together when they do that, but those nest sites are like little territories and they don't overlap. So there is some spacing on the landscape, and it makes sense to me that would force some hens to end up in some wonky places.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I was going to wonder, just by default, with the landscape the way it is, you're going to have that at this point.
Yeah, and sometimes it works out. It's like, hey, she hatches, and she was in a wonky place. Yeah. Great. You know?
What's the most interesting place you've ever found a nest?
Oh,
where you're
man.
Like, what in the heck?
Oh, we've seen them. Some of the most bizarre that I just couldn't fathom why she did it. We had one in Louisiana in a bottomland forest that had flooded. And so imagine like backwater flooded, no vegetation. And she was sitting there. I could see her from about 90 yards.
Oh, wow.
So we walk in trying to figure out where this nest is. And while she's incubating, we don't do that anymore with the GPS work we have. But back in the day, we had to manually track into the bird, and we'd put a little flag and say the nest is about 40 yards over there. You know, we'd get to where we thought we were close. In this case, I could see the bird sitting on the nest. Of course, she flushed because she's like, whoops.
Yeah.
We go over there and mark this nest, and it literally, you could see this bird from almost 100 yards in that, because there was not a stitch of vegetation anywhere around her.
Wow.
That's why absolutes when you speak in, it seems like anytime we say something that's absolute, it's like, oh, well, they go and prove it's wrong. Like they're always going to be nesting in grass or shrubs or somewhere like, nope, she's nesting in the landscape, you know, that person's yard or whatever. Yeah.
They're like human beings. They're all different. There's no such thing as an average.
I was doing the fawn study in Virginia. We had thermal imaging units. We'd go out at night. And so we found some turkey nests. One was out in the middle of it was just wide open, big timber, just right there in the middle. And they just molded up leaves right around. She was sitting right there, wide open, one. Another one was right against the roadway, secondary road, and it was a fern. It had grown up like one fern, just kind of canopied over, and she was tucked up right there. It's a little mound of a hill.
One of the coolest ones I've ever seen was – This was in one of our pine sites. Imagine like a 12-year-old plantation, so nothing but pine needles in the understory. Not a stitch of green stuff. Mm. She nested in that and hatched a full clutch because there was a little dip in the terrain.
Right.
And there was a logging road. I mean, you could see the logging road from the nest. It hit her as if she were invisible, because any predator walking down that road, unless they winded her, would have no clue she was there. Yet you could, had it not been for that little, you know, that little dip, she would have been sitting there like the one in Louisiana. But she hatched. She sat there for a month with, you know, surely things walking up and down that logging road, no clue she was there.
Wow. It's amazing. So what about, talking about brood rearing cover, let's try to define that.
Yeah, so that's easier.
Okay.
Yeah, so brood cover has to be open. And open doesn't have to be treeless. It just needs to be open. So if it's a forest, it needs to be open understory. Something that has bare ground where poults can move around, has to have lots of insects. That's the key. Has to have a lot of insects. And the way to produce insects is succulent vegetation. Have to have green vegetation. You guys know this. Anything that will produce green vegetation, disturbance, disking,
prescribed fire,
anything that's going to produce succulent vegetation that will attract bugs, that's your start. And then you're looking for, needs to be low growing, needs to have escape cover nearby, you know, things that this bird can run under, things they can hop over the first couple of weeks. Once they're flighted after about 2 weeks, the playing field changes because they can avoid predators very efficiently. And if you've ever, you know, if you ever try to walk in on a brood that's 3 weeks old, good luck. I mean, they can haul it and get away from you. But the first couple of weeks, they need that low-growing vegetation with some escape cover they can get under.
You have a list of like some of your favorites to see in that area?
We actually, I'm trying to develop a YouTube channel to show this, and I'm getting close. But we video. We go to these areas where these birds brood, and we take GoPro video.
Sure.
And it would startle you some of the places these birds end up brooding. And like we were talking about pre-show, is the only reason they would go to some of these what I consider bizarre sites is because they feel the need to. They're brooding in all sorts of places. And some of them look to me like good brood cover. And some look crazy. It's like, why did she walk through this? But she made it. She, you know, they ended up surviving. The ones that I think are picture perfect, you know, at least in the deep south, are bottomland sites, dense canopy, yet also have a lush green understory. We've all turkey hunted. If you've turkey hunted in the deep south, you've ended up in a bottom where you just thought, there's a strutter. He's got to be here. I mean,
yeah. Like cool season grasses coming in, Mayapple stuff.
Yeah, riparian areas, you know, creeks, wet, shrubby on the sides where they can climb up and roost at night type of thing. And the problem is, at least in a lot of the systems we work in, those areas are declining. And I'll give you an example that's a bit sad, but it worked out. One of the most frequently used sites on brooding areas on one of our study sites is this lush series of hardwood bottoms that go all over this property, 30,000 acre property. And most of these broods end up in bottoms that are dominated by Japanese stilt grass.
Mm.
So you have an invasive species that is providing what these hens perceive as the best brood cover.
Gosh, that hurts.
If that doesn't tell you that we have an issue we need to address at a broad scale, nothing will.
Absolutely.
It startled me and they're bugs. Don't get me wrong. We go in and where these broods are, and we sample insects, and we end up finding a lot of bugs. But when I go back and look at some of the seminal works in this field from people that I idolized, frankly, as a student, they captured a lot more bugs at their sites where broods were than we do. And it just
native
makes,
versus non-native.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Just more sunlight, more disturbance.
Whatever. You know, okay. I think a combination of all that. You know, more disturbance back then, plant communities that were attractive to insects that that don't exist now. And then, like we were talking about, you know, these global declines in insect diversity and abundance, they're not just happening in obscure places on other parts of the planet. They're happening right here on our landscape, and that has to, by de facto, affect this species. To affect turkeys.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. You said something yesterday that kind of really stuck with me. Moving brood is a dead brood.
Yep.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so we found that, you know, what these birds want to do is right out of the box, as soon as those poults are able to walk, she's gone. So if they hatch late in the afternoon, she'll hold on until the following morning, and then they're booking it out of there. If she hatches overnight and into the morning, by that afternoon, she's gone. And it places these poults in a really interesting situation because they're scaled to her. And what I mean by that is they have to be able to keep up with her. And in the turkey, if you look back in earlier literature, they can. If they're getting bugs and they can eat, they grow really fast and they can take off. The problem is you don't want them doing that. You want her to be able to get away from the nest because of all the dangers associated with a hatching clutch. Sight, sound, smell. Once she hatches, she needs to move away as quickly as she can and then let those poults start eating. So what we've seen is that they usually move about 200 yards away from the nest right out of the box. First day of hatch, they're gone. And then they have two options. If they're encountering good brood habitat or what they perceive as good brood habitat, lots of bugs, low-growing vegetation, they hang out. And they spend the next few days moving a little bit more each day. But then there are some other broods that they hatch, and all of a sudden, they're gone. They'll literally take two-day-old poults and move them a half mile.
Wow.
And the only reason they would ever do that is they don't perceive that they have quality brood habitat available to them, otherwise they'd use it.
Sure.
And those broods, that's what I meant by a moving brood is a dead brood. Those broods across the board had lower, if not zero, survival. So if they're moving, they're dead.
So how does a manager or a landowner take that information and go, okay, I want to help the turkeys?
Yeah, so in our study sites, and the conclusion we came up to, it was about 800 yards, as you remember. It was like 800 yards, 800 to 1,000 yards. So from a management perspective, what I took out of that analysis was, if you think this area is nesting cover, let's just say it's dense, herbaceous, grassy, shrubby, and you know turkeys are nesting in that area, put a dot in the center of it and take 800 meters or 800 yards and just draw a circle around that spot, that stand. And if you don't have something that you can walk through easily that you're literally not seeing bugs jumping up around your boots
as you're walking,
and doesn't have green, lush, herbaceous vegetation, you don't have what you need for that bird. She's going to go find a place those poults, or she thinks those poults, can use to survive. So that to me was a take home. Draw a circle around every stand that you think is nesting cover or fits the bill for nesting cover, which we've kind of already talked about, can be almost anything.
Yeah.
So when I started doing that on our study sites, it hit me like a brick. It was like, wow, a lot of this landscape is not even reproductive habitat for this bird. They could nest there, but they'd have to travel 2 miles to get to an opening that's brood cover. That, to me, was startling, and it jives exactly with the data that we see. It's like, well, why didn't they go over there? It's like, well, that's not brooding habitat. I thought it would be, but the birds don't perceive it that way.
So that's terrifying when you think about the South. You think about a lot of places, even in the Ozark Mountains or Wachita Mountains, where you see these vast landscapes of timber, solid timber, closed canopy. There's not much underneath. It's like if there's a group of population, a population of turkeys here, and they don't necessarily nest together, another one's got to go find nesting somewhere that they maybe not have been that much. And then they're going to have to find brood rearing cover adjacent to that, maybe in a landscape they've not been to. And
yes.
Yeah. No wonder turkey numbers are declining.
You're talking just timber, but we can't forget about just crop fields that are dissed under, and it's just dirt. That's massive areas in the upper Midwest and Midwest.
And I kind of like, and if you think about turkeys, I kind of perceive their populations across the landscape as a bunch of light bulbs. And what we've seen is these light bulbs get dimmer in some places and they get brighter in others. Mm-hmm. But in most of the South, the bulb gets a little bit dimmer every single year. So they're not producing as many poults. Those poults aren't surviving. It may not be this dramatic change from year to year, but what's happening is just a little, no pun intended, pecking away at these flocks. And to what we've just discussed, if there's even a small percentage change in the availability of nesting habitat and a small change in the availability of brood habitat at one of those light bulbs, just one light bulb, it gets dimmer. And then the adjacent light bulb might get brighter, may get dimmer. What you see is across the Southeast is the picture gets darker and darker and darker. Does that make sense? In other words, the light bulbs are getting dimmer, but they're not going out. They're not blinking out.
Yeah.
So we perceive it as, well, we have turkeys everywhere. We do. I mean, we have turkeys. I mean, they're doing fine in many places, but the light bulb's getting a little bit dimmer.
It feels like the Bob White quail during the 70s or 80s, where it was like there were still numbers, but it was like starting to notice a downward trend. And now, I mean, it's not a great conversation to have about
there's
overall
populations and quail, different species, but there's areas that are really hot, and there's areas that they're just no more.
Yeah,
they're done.
And you know, I hear the quail analogy used, and the one big difference between a turkey and a quail is, outside of their size, obviously, turkeys are much more plastic than quail.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are big birds.
Thankfully.
They can eat a lot of stuff. They can become omnivores, carnivores. They're big, they're strong, they're resilient. But we as managers still have to provide the resources they need.
So how does a land manager manage on a broad scale? Say a landowner's got 200 acres or 300 acres or 1,000 acres that is a lot of timber. How are they going to take this information and go, okay, let's make a change?
Unless you own large tracts, being 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 plus acres, you don't have a turkey population. You don't have a light bulb, if you will.
Yeah.
You're sharing the light bulb with all your neighbors. So I tell people, understand what this bird needs starting January 1 through December 31.
It's like he's listened to the podcast before. I like that.
You know, winter covers hardwood areas. Mm-hmm. They're going to move a lot. You're going to lose your turkeys, and they're going to go on somebody else's property, again, unless you own huge swaths. And that's fine. Yep. They are going to come back to areas, and they're going to reproduce. These turkeys basically use what's called an exploded lek, and all that means is you take like a prairie chicken lek and throw a bomb in it. So instead of having all the males in one spot displaying, you have pockets, light bulbs of males that are displaying, and there's some hens that breed with them, and that's it. So you got these little pockets of birds, and those pockets don't live on you. They don't live just on your property unless you own a lot of acres. So understand that you need to be thinking, this bird is probably going to leave your area, end up on an adjacent landowner's property, and then either return or not.
Yeah.
And I talk to people all the time. They're like, well, I own 500 acres, and I have birds in the spring, but I don't ever see them in the summer.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. And that's why co-ops would be a great
thing. Exactly, co-ops. And I always ask people, well, do you have nesting cover? Oh, yeah. You know, I got plenty of stuff, sticks, dents, great. Do you have any openings? Nope. I've got a couple food plots. That's not an opening to a turkey. I mean, a brood's not going to use a half-acre food plot for 28 days.
Yeah.
She's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
If that puts her on your neighbor's property, then that's why you don't see any birds in the summer.
I
talk to people that are like, well, I see lots of turkeys in the fall and winter, and then come March, they're gone. Yep. You don't have reproductive habitat that's going to hold this bird, so start thinking about who does around you and work with them.
Gotcha. What about, this is a question I get a lot. We talk about great quality habitat for turkeys, but then the question always comes up, well, how come the turkeys are doing so good on so-and-so's dairy farm?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think there is about the cattle operation or the dairy farm that makes that farm, even though the habitat may not be as good, there's always turkeys there?
They are going to go to openings, period. And I hear this a lot, too. It's ironic you said that. And I caution people when I hear that. You don't know where those turkeys came from. They may have come from quite a ways off to use your dairy farm. You may end up attracting birds from all over the landscape that would not be there would your neighbors manage sure. for their openings and early successional habitat better yeah. than they're currently doing.
Yep.
So I caution people about, hey, they're all on this, they're all in these cattle farms. Well, maybe they're there because they feel like they have to be
yeah.
rather than being where they would prefer to be, if that yeah. makes sense.
And if just like the Japanese stiltgrass analogy, if they have to go to overgrazed fescue because they feel like that's where they have to be, makes you kind of go.
That's an issue.
Ooh, that's a big yeah, issue.
That's an issue.
That's a red flag.
There's grasshoppers out in most hay fields or cattle pastures, but to what density? Can
yeah.
it be improved? Right. Absolutely it can be, but not in mature timber
right.
or closed canopy timber.
Right.
It's not
yeah.
improved.
Yeah, and what you'd see in most forest communities is they're not managed effectively for this bird.
No.
They just aren't. The canopy's too closed. There's not enough disturbance. The stem density's too high.
You can have mass production, great mass production, in a woodland or savanna settings. You
Absolutely.
Don't have to have closed canopy timber to have acorns.
Yeah. Right, right.
You don't have to. And that's what that dynamic diversity in the landscape of grasses, forbs, trees, you can have all that in those
right.
landscapes.
So a managed forest is what you would, you
absolutely.
Know, some sort of disturbance. We're getting some sunlight coming down. You're getting some more annuals, more perennials filling in later on. You continue to burn. So we're harvesting timber. We're thinning timber. We're burning.
Absolutely.
Constant disturbance.
I mean, and depending on the forest community, in some forests, turkeys are inextricably linked to disturbance.
Yeah.
If you're not disturbing the forest community, you're not benefiting this bird.
Yeah. Or,
not everywhere. But
or CRP is too rank in warm season grasses.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this bird needs disturbance that's going to maintain vegetation communities that are low growing, producing bugs, producing nest sites. If you're walking through the forest and you see a sweet gum understory, and that's it,
bears.
You're doing something wrong.
Or Chinese yeah. privet.
Or Chinese privet, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
absolutely.
Oh, man.
Have you gotten to do any...
I got to turn Chad's...
Chad stepped
I'm
in
chiming
here.
In. There's a man in the back.
Have you gotten to do any research on, like, patch burn grazing areas? Has that been anywhere?
I have not.
That was
no.
something we were discussing yesterday after listening to your seminar on whether that would affect, because, you know, the bug factor with the cattle...
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder how that would affect where it's managed grazing in amongst the burning
mm-hmm,
and stuff,
mm-hmm.
how that would, because, you know, it's generally a little more open underneath
right,
and
right.
stuff. It's like, I wonder how that would contribute.
I have not done work in that arena, but to me, it's common sense
yes.
that would be a beneficial way of managing those type of plant
yeah.
communities, because you don't, as you know, with cattle, unless you overgraze it, you do end up with a kind of a heterogeneous type plant community, and then you get the cows out and you let it regenerate and you have what we're looking for. But as you know, a lot of producers don't do that. You know,
yeah.
They
yeah.
they're going
unfortunately.
intensively graze it and then move to another pasture.
Oh,
yeah.
They move their cattle where you're at?
when it gets to be really short grass. Yeah.
Well, that's a forcing, so that's just
yeah.
not by management
yeah.
style.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
gosh,
yeah.
man.
They,
we
actually,
go on for days on that.
The cows probably busted the fence
busted
and moved themselves.
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's you know, we hear that. So I have an ag background, and talking in the regenerative ag where people are still getting into rotational grazing, they're talking a lot about yeah, I guess we need to start wrapping up. We've got another appointment you have to go to. But you hear that a lot. There's a buzz on these landscapes. There's a lot more insects. And it
mm-hmm.
makes you wonder, okay, if a person uses cattle correctly, they create a disturbance as well as attract more insects through manure and just
and we found that with Kyle and Frank in their research as well.
Absolutely.
From a nesting success, brood rearing, it's increasing quail numbers when managed appropriately. Cattle are.
Yeah.
Same thing can likely be said from a wild turkey standpoint.
Yeah, and somebody came up to me after the talk yesterday and asked, are all insects created the same when it comes to a turkey? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. If they're eating every kind of insect out there, something's amiss. They will select spiders and different species, grasshoppers, things that move in front of them because they're very visual. Poults are very visual. They see something, and you know, I mean, turkeys are visual, right?
Yeah.
So they, you know, when they're foraging, they see something move, and that's where they direct their attention. Well, if there's nothing moving, then what are they going to eat? They're not going to just root around and go find something. So a lot of insects that you would see on the landscape really aren't turkey food.
Sure.
They're just insects. You know, no offense to bug people, but
they have some other role.
Yeah, they have another role that I don't understand.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, I won't profess to.
Well, we can't thank you enough for stopping by.
Absolutely.
And
you're welcome.
Man, we're going to have you on in the future with all your other research that we didn't get to talk about.
I'd be glad to.
Scribe Flyer, you name it. We'll have you back on. So, sir, appreciate
it. Be glad
to.
Yep. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Next up to bat for the big rendezvous National Wild Turkey Federation National Convention, we have on another researcher, Brett Collier from LSU.
Yes, we'll try not to talk about the national championship today.
Okay? Keeping on turkeys.
I wasn't even thinking about that.
I wore an LSU shirt yesterday here, and that's not a single turkey question. Like, well, what about Joe Burrow? I could care less.
So, yeah, we're going to talk about habitat, turkeys, all things diversity, and anything else you want to chat about
Native
with your research.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it.
So we sat through a seminar of yours today.
Unfortunate for you.
And you talked a lot of different things, but let's go ahead and try to get our viewers to understand what it was you covered.
So today I was asked by the National Wild Turkey Federation to give a talk about what makes a turkey have a successful nest at the end of the day. From a professional turkey biologist standpoint, the kind of missing link in all the science that we do and all the knowledge that we have and the limitation for turkey population growth across the United States is that nest success, or the percentages of nests that actually hatch one poult, is about 20%. Which means that 8 out of every 10 nests died, you know, gets predated typically. And the discussion that I kind of outlined today was some of the issues that historically we've had from a scientific perspective on what we thought drove nest success and impacted nest success. And then some of the new information we're garnering from the birds and changes in technology that we've had to kind of better evaluate how nests that are successful succeed and what potential things may be limiting their success. That was the really short version of a very long talk today.
Yeah.
So
so it was very interesting. You're talking, you know, we had Mike on earlier. Not sure how we'll drop it because we may put him at the second half of this. Because
well, then we had Mike on later is probably where we'll go.
That's right. Yeah. So you went from nest research and then he went into brood rearing.
Yes.
And so basically we're going into life cycle of the beginning stages of a turkey's life. Basically, kind of explain why that's important for us.
Sure.
Why it's important that we should care about the success rate of a nest.
Absolutely. So to the average everyday turkey hunter, and I'll use my dad as an example.
Him under the bus.
I'll throw him under the bus. I'm sorry, Dad, you're going to hear this and be mad at me. You know, my father is an avid hunter. He's hunted white-tailed deer. He grew up hunting pheasants and quail. I got him into turkey hunting about 15 years ago. He knows absolutely nothing about turkey biology. But what he does know how to do is use a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
And my job as a scientist is I'm the backstop. So I'm the guy or one of the guys with my state agency personnel that I work with, and our responsibility is to maintain sustainable turkey populations for aesthetic enjoyment and recreational harvest in my state and a great many states. And for every turkey that gets harvested, a turkey has to replace it.
Yep.
And the scientific field of turkey biology are kind of bottleneck, is and has always been the period of reproduction, because that's when we get more turkeys. In a perfect world, every time a female wild turkey, a hen, lays a clutch, you know, about 11 eggs, then you want 11 babies. But that's not really true. So to put it in a kind of a raw percentage terms, we're talking about a bird that has a 40-day life cycle wholly tied to reproduction. They lay about one egg a day for around 12 to 14 days, depending upon they skip a day in between. And then once the eggs are all laid, they incubate those eggs for about 28 days. There's a little variability in there. So basically, you've got about 12 days of laying eggs and then about 28 days of sitting on the eggs. And when you think about how big a turkey's range is, and I use this analogy today, a female wild turkey has a range of a few thousand acres. And if you were to put yourself in a house that's about 2,000 square feet, she effectively spends that month of incubation, that 28 days of incubation, sitting in her downstairs bathroom and never leaving it. Mm-hmm. Even when she moves off to feed, she's still in the bathroom. So she's in this very constricted range space, and at best, she's going to get two shots at it. So if her nest isn't successful the first time, she's probably going to try and re-nest one more time. So now you've got this bird that is stuck effectively all day long, all night, for 28 straight days, only leaving the nest site to go defecate and maybe forage or get water a little bit. Sometimes these birds don't leave the nest site for two or three days in a row. Sometimes they make what are called recess movements. They'll move off a couple hundred meters, eat real quick something, maybe be gone for an hour and come back. recess movements are kind of tied to foraging, but they're also tied to thermoregulatory activities of the nest. They've got to keep the eggs at a certain temperature. So basically, this bird is paying attention to this little spot on the landscape. For about 28 days consistently, she's there, and then for about 40 days all told. During that time frame, that bird has to actively maintain that nest, turn the eggs, keep them warm, and pretty much everything else on the landscape wants to eat that nest or her. And predation is, we typically talk about predation in the context that we were talking earlier about catching predators and does it have any impact. I'm not going to give a good answer to that. We'll go down that in a minute. But what causes turkey nests to fail is something eats them. Typically what you get are, when you put cameras out on nests, what you see are, somebody has a sexy picture of a fox at a nest, or, you know, there'll be a bobcat, or there'll be a coyote, or, you know, feral pig seems to be the new thing that everybody says.
Right.
It's snakes. The primary predator of nests, of almost all ground nesting birds, is snakes. Now, I don't know if that percentage is 50% of all the nests that fail are snakes, or 30%, or, you know, 65%. I don't know if a snake predates a nest and then a feral hog just comes and cleans up afterwards.
Right.
But what we do know is that most of the things that are predating nests are not eating the turkey, the female turkeys.
The hen herself.
Yeah, the hen, most of the time. So we looked at, over about the last 4 or 5 years, we've monitored over 500 females on nests. And only about 10% of the time are those females killed during the nesting period. And sometimes they're not killed by the standard predator. I mean, everybody typically thinks bobcats and coyotes, right? Mm-hmm. Raccoon's not very rarely going to kill a turkey. It's not going to be a possum. Owls wreak havoc on turkeys a lot of time. Barred owls and great horned owls, they fly and take their heads right off. But you can usually find the hen on the nest, or maybe she's scavenged after that. But only about 10% of the time does nest loss is the same as female loss. So the other 90% of the time that a nest fails, something had to eat the nest. Snakes are a big part of that. And there's no way to manage for snakes. So everybody, yeah, I mean, right? Yeah. What are you going to do, go out and catch rat snakes in the woods? It's probably not that useful. So what managers do is they try to create usable space. We want to provide turkeys with the optimal amount of choice so that they can find what they need on the landscape or what they think they need. And, you know, the state agencies and the Forest Service and work real hard on doing that on public lands. And then private landowners, there's a, you know, a little different vibe because they sometimes don't have the resources. I don't have a whole bunch of tractors to use on my farm in Illinois. I mean, I've got a drip torch and a flapper, but that's about it. Couple tractors. So, you know, what we preach at those scales is you're basically managing for diversity. Is really what we're getting at, is you want to provide the optimal amount of vegetation community so that the birds can potentially find what they need. But once we get into reproduction, I mean, it's really a dynamic and a really complex question, because how a bird behaves affects whether its nest is successful or not. You know, if we can get a nest, right now, if we can get a nest to 22 days, then that female will hunker down and she won't move for the next 6 days.
Why do you think that is? That because you mentioned that in the presentation. You said that 22 days there was 100% nest success
after that point.
Between that 22 to 28 day period.
Right. So females, I don't want to say are conspicuous, because they're built to be non-conspicuous, right?
Right.
To predators, but they're still conspicuous on the landscape.
Sure.
And everything eats turkey nests, right? But for some reason, and it's not for some reason, so backing up, about 75% of your nests fail before day 14.
Mm-hmm.
So you get 2 weeks into the, you know, a bird having a nest, 75% of those nests are going to fail. They're just, something's going to eat them, and it's done. And then there's this window from about day 14 to about day 21 or 22 where the birds tend to spend a little bit more time on the nest, but not much. But then something we think, because it's hard to know what's going on inside a turkey's you know, little pea-sized brain. we think that something clicks and they're like, I'm in the home stretch.
Mm.
I need to put all of my resources into hatching this nest. And that's interesting to think about, because female wild turkeys will abandon a nest under almost any threat of predation. They will not defend their nest against something that will eat them. So if a bobcat comes blowing in, that turkey is gone.
Right.
Fox, well, other than that one Gould's in Arizona that you guys saw today, a fox, gone. A coyote, gone. But they will bow up on snakes.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen hens fight with 6-foot indigo snakes
in
South Texas. We've seen
hens.
Yeah, I mean, they'll peck the tar out of rat snakes,
mm-hmm.
And then they'll line their eggs up and push them back into the nest bowl and continue incubating. So a turkey always chooses to live over to reproduce. That probably plays a little bit of a role. We're not sure how much of a role yet. But the real rub, and I know you guys are going to ask this question, so I'll preemptively say it. Well, why don't we just do predator management, right?
We wouldn't say that.
Not necessarily us.
Right,
a lot of people are wondering.
How about this? I'm sure your listeners are saying, well, why don't we just catch all the predators on the landscape?
Right.
And the issue is that with that is you can't.
Yeah.
Predators fill a void. The more that you catch, the more that you're going to keep catching. Now, there has been a lot of really good work done on ducks. Delta waterfowl is a leader in this type of thing. And where they go in and they remove all the predators and they put up fences. And miraculously enough, if you go to 2 acres or 9 acres and you trap everything out, you know, nest success goes up. But I don't know how you trap out crows.
Right, yeah.
Or hawks.
Well, and see, what I'm thinking while you were talking about this, of you talk about snakes being so high. Well, if we're removing all of these other predators, they're going to eat snakes.
Snakes aren't getting eaten.
Snakes are going to – I mean, it's one of those that we don't – a lot of people normally don't think in terms of
– They don't think through
the cycle. Remove one predator,
may increase another predator population.
Yes, there's a predator release hypothesis. I think is what you're talking about. That's way too nerdy for your listeners. We'll get that. But there was a really interesting thing that came up the other day, and I know we're at the NWTF convention, but it popped up on the QDMA website. And they were looking at coyotes, mm-hmm. and I always tell people, always ask me, how much damage do coyotes do to turkeys? And I'm like, not very much.
Right.
Eat some eggs, and you know, if they can get a hold of a female, you know, a hen or a gobbler, they will, but you know, they're not running through the woods trying to eat coyotes. And they published this study that was done, I think, out of the University of Georgia and a few other places, and they found no avian DNA in all the coyote scats that were collected across the entire year. There was no avian DNA, so that means they sure weren't. I mean, it was mainly deer, right? Deer, and I think they were eating a bunch of berries and vegetation and some, you know, that kind of
rabbits,
stuff.
Rabbits, rodents.
Yeah, that kind of jazz. You know, there was no turkey in there. And when I try to explain that to people, I think that, you know, coyotes get a bad rap because everybody sees coyotes during deer season. Yeah, and, you know, we got to shoot all the coyotes and save the turkeys. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to a little bit of removal might save a turkey here or there, right?
Yeah.
But
landscape-wise,
the scale that scientists work on and that managers manage on is not a scale that localized trapping has an impact.
Correct.
So when you get into that situation, it goes into some of the things we talked about today. Why are some nests successful and others aren't? Predators probably move through the landscape in a fairly random process. You get predator satiation at certain times. You know, whenever fawns are hitting the ground, coyotes are not hunting anything else.
Yeah.
They're eating fawns. So, you know, as we think about where turkey nests are at in the landscape, there are probably, as there are areas where turkeys don't want to be on the landscape, there are probably areas that predatory species don't want to be on the landscape. And if we can identify vegetative communities that are less conducive to predation activity, then the creation and management of those might be an additional alternative to the toolbox that turkey biologists already have.
Increasing the rate of reproduction.
Increasing the rate of reproduction. And you know, people don't think about, people hear 80% and they don't really realize what that means, because it's not just 80% of the nests fail. It means for every 100, and if you think about the math on this, very simply, you have 100 nests, 20 of them successfully hatch. Only two or three of those are successfully going to bring one poult to 28 days old. That's what the numbers say right now.
Wow.
That hurts.
Yes.
Yeah. That's bad.
It does, because, and poults die from everything. I mean, literally, you look at them wrong and they fall over, right? It's not always predation, but
get ran over by UTV.
Ran over by UTV. Once you get poults into trees, the survival rate for the broods, I guess I should talk about broods versus individual poults, but once the brood gets to about 14 days, you know, somewhere, you know, 12 days, 16 days, and they start roosting in the trees, their survival rate skyrockets.
Right.
I mean, it shoots almost to one after that point. So there's that critical period of about the first 2 weeks where a lot of us are spending a lot of time looking at vegetation. So it's hard to identify what vegetation is good for turkey nests, because turkey nests, they put nests everywhere, right? But broods are a little bit different. Historically, kind of the way we thought was that the female would take the poults someplace she thought foraging was good. And kind of over time, we've learned that what the female is really doing is she's keeping the poults between the white lines, and the poults are actually looking for food, and they're kind of leading where they go. So they find an area that's really good, and they peck around at it. So what we've done is, with the advent of being able to put GPS units on turkeys, which I think Mike probably talked about it, and I will, we're able to actually say, okay, hen 1632 was right here. We know she was brooding, and she spent 3 hours at this spot. And then we will go out there with a GoPro and a whole bunch of stupid science stuff that nobody cares about, and Robel poles and cover boards and all that kind of jazz. We'll actually evaluate what's there. We'll do insect net sweeps to see what the density of insects is. And then we can link how poults are moving through the landscape to the vegetative communities on the very fine scale that they're spending the most time in. And some of them, I'll be honest with you guys, whenever we started doing this, some of them were really surprising. In the old days, with VHF, you had to chase the bird, right? So you had to go out and follow the beeps. Yep. And chase. I mean, and there's a great story about a professor is sitting on a road in a truck and the graduate student's off chasing the bird in the woods, and the hen carrying the tag and the poults walk right across the road in front of him while the grad student's over there trying to figure out where they're at. And because he pushed them. Now we're able to be a lot more hands-off. Mm-hmm. So we get a very raw, non-disturbed, raw is a good word, non-disturbed view of what they're using. And that's a new area for us, because then the question comes in, okay, what was here? And I'll be honest with you, we find poults in areas, you know, most people think that field edges, right? There's usually lots of diversity along a field edge, and poults are using it a bunch. Yeah, we see that. We also find them foraging heavily in wet, swampy bottomland hardwoods and running ridge lines. And in early successional, open, fairly open canopy pine, and occasionally skirting the edges of, you know, 15-year-old loblolly plantations that's got, you know, a year's worth of undergrowth under it, right, and that kind of thing. So it's interesting. There's been some really good work on fire lately, mm-hmm, in this, especially in the Southeast and the Midwest, looking at what impact fire has on where females are nesting at and where they're taking their broods. And we're basically finding that about a year, females like to nest in what we call like a two-year rough. So it's about 2 years post-fire. First year post-fire, you get just a little bit of ground vegetation. There's not a lot of woody cover, depending on the patchiness of the fire. But about that second year, it gets pretty thick, right? But they are perfectly happy to take their broods right into that last year's fire or the one that just burned. And, I mean, yep, I've seen poults and fires that have went through before, and they're just out there pecking up dead beetles and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like popcorn. You know, I mean, just literally following the fire trail. So there's been some really neat stuff on that that I think is, now that we're getting more fire on the landscape at the right, doing some of these spring burns, I think we're going to see some positive response for that at the more landscape scale.
Well, time out there, because I read on a deep, dark internet that spring burns are burning up turkey nests.
Oh, yeah.
And don't act like you've never heard that one.
Yeah. So I assume that has something to do with the Facebook, man. Right?
Probably.
I've heard about that deep, dark internet, and that's why I avoided it at all costs.
Stay away.
I just stay away. No, that's a good question. So here's what I'll say. I can guarantee beyond the shadow of a doubt that at some point a prescribed burn is going to impact a turkey nest. I guarantee it. We've looked at hundreds of nests in some of the most intensively burned environment landscapes in the Southeast. Places like the Webb Center Wildlife Management Area in South Carolina, right? Cedar Creek and BF Grant WMAs in Georgia. You know, we've looked at stuff on the Jones Center. We've looked at stuff in the Kisatchee National Forest in Louisiana, the Angelina National Forest in Texas, right? These are all eastern wild turkey areas where prescribed burning is used actively. I would say that we've probably had, because I've got a count and I'm trying to think through all of them, maybe two nests out of 500 that we've had telemeter birds on that are impacted by fire. Neither one of them has actually been, I think maybe one was actually burned. Another one, the female put out the fire and continued nesting in a big black patch, right, and successfully right, hatched. You know, the benefits, here's what I tell people. The benefits from prescribed burning are wide-ranging relative to the minute amount of loss, because we're not burning in the areas that turkeys are nesting in.
Correct. Those were already probably burnt,
yes,
more recently.
These birds are nesting in areas that were burned a year or two ago, and most burn regimes are every, say, 4 years, or
yes,
maybe a little longer, maybe a little shorter in some cases, but usually around every 4 years. So those birds aren't actually nesting where we're doing the fires. And we have to keep that rotation moving in the landscape.
Definitely.
Or you're not going to have these areas that the birds generally select, these two-year roughs. So, you know, fire gets a bad rap. It shouldn't. I mean, as I said, you know, I guarantee there are times when nests get burned. But, I mean, I got a great picture one of my graduate students took of a rat snake or a coach whip that had been caught up in a fire, and an armadillo had, and it had obviously eaten a turkey nest because it had a whole bunch of turkey eggs in it. An armadillo had caught this after the snake had died in the fire and went and ripped open the snake and was eating the eggs out of the inside of the snake. Yeah, it's
great.
That's
funny.
So, you know, the positive benefits of prescribed burning on the landscape, spring burning, far outweigh the negative benefits. Opinions vary. I tend to go with what I see and what the data says, and our data says that we're not seeing, we're not wholesale burning up all the turkey nests on the landscape. You know, there are potentially areas where that could occur. That is, you know, some military bases that are open for hunting, but also have to be for military training. I mean, they get a lot of fire from, you know, artillery and that
munitions.
Kind of stuff. It just happens, right? But at the landscape scale, we're all also, you have to realize, we're not burning 60% of Louisiana every year, or 50% of South Carolina. So the amount of I wish we were, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But the amount of actual burning we're putting on the landscape is relatively small relative to the amount of vegetation that's out there. So we're probably
I think it ties in again with what you were saying earlier. We tend to look at things in a smaller scale when you're looking in a large landscape style, and we're focusing on this small area when we should be looking at it in a large landscape style.
Right, and I wish, honestly, that more people that focus on the small scale realize that, you know, maybe if you're managing, you know, 300 acres or 500 acres, I understand some people are leasing from timber company and there are limitations there, but, you know, if you're managing a few hundred acres, it doesn't mean you can't rotate fire through every few years in small patches.
Absolutely.
and create that diverse set of habitats, that mosaic on the landscape that everybody really wants to see.
Yeah, because it sounds like with nesting, it may be 2 years post-fire versus brood rearing maybe 1 year post-fire or immediately after a fire.
Even immediately after, yeah.
And so from a land manager standpoint, okay, I've got several units. I can have that across my farm. But managing a population in a region is going to require major fires.
Right.
Lots of fires.
That's one of the things that – and I said earlier about the difficulty in – downscaling and upscaling, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, my job and the job of all the state agency biologists here that work very hard to maintain turkeys is we have to take the 10,000-foot view, right?
Yeah.
We're thinking about sustainability of the resource at the regional or statewide level, and I want to help you with your 400 acres or your 1,300 acres or your 600 acres. I want to do things, But the questions that we're tasked with answering is for the good of all.
Yeah.
You know, and we can downscale some of it, but you can't always downscale all of it, right?
Yeah.
You know, because if you have 200 acres, you can create all the nesting habitat or vegetation community diversity that you want, and you may not have 50 turkeys nesting on it. You may have one, and that's great.
Yeah.
You know, but we work at a scale. I work at a scale, and the state people do. That's a little bit higher because we have to, because we're looking out for, you know, longevity of the species. I mean, I'm a turkey hunter. I love turkey hunting, and I want to be turkey hunting 35 years from now with my kid. You know, when I'm old and retired, and she's wanting me to go with her. So that's kind of the target that I have, and given what we see in the Southeast, the Northeast, and the Midwest with these kind of concurrent slow declines of our poult per hen ratios for the last 15 or 20 years. I mean, that's kind of the level that we're trying to work at right now.
Absolutely. I think you said, you know, you're looking at that higher, let's say, level space, but there's still all this research, and it's kind of, let's say, our job. We take some responsibility there of understanding that research, talking to you about it, and then making it applicable to that landowner.
Yes.
So then that, whether he has a relationship with his neighbor, they can begin to work collectively and build out a larger area in which a lot of people are coming together and doing these techniques.
Oh, some of the most successful areas where turkey restoration has been most successful is where you have I think they call them cooperatives, where you have a group of cooperatives where you have and sometimes the cooperatives are all private landowners, right? Sometimes the cooperatives are a state agency has a wildlife management area, and then they've got, you know, a mine that's got a piece of property right next to them, or a private landowner, and they engage in some sort of a relationship that says, okay, we're all going to manage like that. I mean, those have been super successful. And the reason that those are, I don't know if targeted is the right word, but are extremely useful from a turkey management perspective is that a lot of times the original restoration standards, and even some of them now, require minimum acreage before they'll even consider putting turkeys on a place. You have to have, and I'll use East Texas as an example, as they're continuing their restoration efforts, right? It's on the boundary, it's on the western boundary of the Eastern Wild Turkeys Range. Demography is typically much more stochastic or much more variable on the boundary edges, right? I mean, as opposed to Mississippi and Alabama, it's going to be a lot different in Texas, in East Texas. So, you know, they have, Jason Harden, the turkey biologist in Texas, has minimum standards. You have to have X number of contiguous acres before we can even, and it's got to meet a specific habitat suitability index. It's got to have a specific proportion of open land. It's got to have this type of forest structure before we even thinks about working with them on restocking. And where they've been most successful has been in areas where they've had these cooperative endeavors with either multiple landowners or the state, the feds, and other landowners working together to meet those minimum requirements. And then there's typically restrictions on harvest, and you have to put fire, and, you know, sometimes there's, you know, forestry management practices come into play. But yeah, the cooperative approach to getting a bunch of people working together has always been a really good way to kind of go after this.
Certainly.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. So just talking once again, try to get back to your presentation. We're talking about the overall success. Sounds like I'm a little loud. Oh, the overall success of these nests, and how can we take that as a landowner? And I'm not so much focused. We're all turkey hunters here, most likely, but I'm also a deer guy and a quail guy. Right. How can I? Because you're also the same. So how do you blend all that together and not focus just on one species, but the overall land health?
Well, the beauty of land management, as a general rule at any scale, is that typically anything you do that takes land out of a strict monoculture.
Yep.
And moves it to a, and I use the word diversity, but I'm not sure that's the right word here. Moves it to a more.
Diversity is always the right
good word. Yeah. You're welcome here.
Okay. moves it to a vegetative community that has a variety of components, right? You know, is always going to be better. You know, one of the biggest struggles we see in the Southeast United States with quail. Right, is that we've moved from dirty farming, for lack of a better word, to, you know, fence row to fence row, right? I mean, you know, there's nothing that grows. And unfortunately, we've got great programs with NRCS, you know, and you got CP33 and CP2 and all those that are starting to help bring some of that back. And what they're doing is they're, instead of having this monoculture of, okay, we're going to have this open field, we're going to have a hard edge, and then we're going to go to in a tree or whatever it is, they're starting to work this idea back in of, okay, that edge needs to be softer. We need to have mixtures of early successional woody components, early successional grasslands. Timber harvest is not a bad thing.
Correct.
You know, cutting trees. Trees are a renewable natural resource.
Do you want to stand up on this table and preach?
the forestry guys in my department would love me. I mean, you know, and you look at things like ruffed grouse in Appalachia, right? I mean, we need to cut trees.
Bad.
I mean, it's one of those things. I was having a great conversation with the Kentucky Turkey and Grouse Program Coordinator last week on this. But you want to create that mosaic, might be the right word, at any scale that you can, using a variety of methods, because there's no one thing fits all type of vibe for this. There's no panacea. There's no, hey, if I go over here and put a food plot of chufa in, I'm going to have turkeys.
That's
not exactly how it's going to work. No. I'm not saying that it hurts, but you're better off to think about diversity at the local scale. And going back to your cooperative thing, you know, you may only have a few hundred acres, but you got 10 guys that have a few hundred acres. Now you're in a few thousand acres. And if you start putting this patchwork together on the landscape, then it's better for everything. I mean, turkeys are generalists, right? Yep. And I can scream that at the top of my lungs. Turkeys use everything. We find turkeys in the deserts of Arizona. We find them in the mountains of Montana and Colorado, and we find them in Maine, and we find them in Florida and in the swamps of Louisiana and in the hardwoods of Tennessee, right? They exist everywhere. So that means there's not just one thing that they like. There's a lot of things that they like, but what they don't like is just one thing.
That's right.
Yep,
that's
right.
So you want to make sure that there's enough of a lot of things, and that's really what the target should be.
We're doing something right. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. That's pretty much what we preach. Try to preach all the time, every week. Diversity, mosaic, disturbance.
Yes, absolutely.
And there's a common trend from the guests that have come on, for those listening, that it's not just us saying this. There is biologist research, hard science, that is saying the exact same thing. It's not a silver bullet.
It's just
nature. And it's just
nature. You don't go to Walmart
nature.
Or a sporting goods store and go buy a bag of diversity.
If they sold bags of diversity, I'd know about it. But no.
Which rate do you apply?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. and you're absolutely right. And the beauty of it is, I'm a professional turkey biologist. That's what I do all day, every day, you know, with other things. But, I mean, turkeys are my passion. I think, you know, you guys are interviewing Mike Chamberlain.
Yep.
He's a professional turkey biologist. That's what he does all day, every day. He and I have divergent opinions on things. But there's probably 150 other scientists out there in the United States that are doing the same thing, only from a different angle. Quail biologists studying quail and how diversity of habitats impacts quail. Rough grouse biologists studying deer biologists. Water, you know, and they're all coming to the habitat, just straight vegetation people, range people. They're all of the same opinion that the more diverse a landscape is, the more productive a landscape is. And that's the easiest way to explain it.
Yeah.
Is that if you've got one thing on your landscape, you're growing one thing. But if you've got a whole bunch of stuff on your landscapes, then your reach and the number of species you're touching is a lot higher.
Yeah.
And it tracks all the way down through things like, just as simple things like foraging. If you're a fescue monoculture, you're not going to have the foraging items that certain species of bird, or you know, turkeys or grouse or quail or whatever, are going to want to eat. But if you've got a whole bunch of diversity of different vegetation communities, different age classes of your forest stands, different, you know, densities of edge, then what you've done is you've kind of opened up the buffet to a wider variety of species, right? As opposed to, you know, diversity in a bag. I figured it'd be about $9.99 a pound, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Is there a buck on the front of it or not?
There's a buck, and there's a quail, and there's a wild turkey.
It's going to be expensive then.
Yeah. So, and I'm sure there's probably about four hunting shows labels on it too. Yeah. So, but no, management for diversity is not a rich man's game, and that's, I mean, you know, I'm a faculty member at a university, right? I'm not saying that we don't get paid well, but, I'm not rolling around like Scrooge McDuck, okay? It's pretty easy to implement plans to change and manage and manipulate vegetation at the local scale without a lot of effort. I mean, the National Wild Turkey Federation has a great setup for going out and assisting people with doing prescribed fire on private properties. There's tons of organizations, both state and federal, that are super handy for getting people out to integrate with us. Your local state agency biologists are probably the number one resource on this, because this is what their job is. Their job is to work with local landowners at the local scale on management that affects, because it all does, that trickles up to regional management. And I think that sometimes people are, they don't really like to interact with the state biologist. And, you know, I mean, everybody's an expert on the internet, right?
That's right.
But and I mean, that's
true. You find
that
often.
I mean, everybody's an expert on the internet, even me. But these state biologist people, these are people, this is their job, is to full-time work on and study and learn and help landowners implement these activities. So I think that, you know, if there's any plug that I was to make here, is that if we're managing for diversity, then you need to talk to the people whose job it is to do this.
Yeah.
I tend to sit a little bit higher in that hierarchy of pain, I guess, where I think about it from a scale that's broader than the local area. But I recognize, because I am a guy that owns land and has a little local area, that I've got to do stuff here if I'm going to affect the larger scale.
Yeah.
So, well,
I don't know if we're wrapping up here.
No, you can talk as long as you want to.
But you're in a southeast.
Yes.
And we're talking diversity. And there has been a massive change in the last 60, 70, 80 years or so. And converting a ton of diverse landscapes into monocultures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how openly you could speak on it, but from a future looking out, what do you see from that? And what we're referencing is pine plantations.
Mm-hmm. I knew what you were referencing.
or monoculture
or crop fields,
too.
Agriculture. Go ahead, please.
Well, I guess, you know, One of the big things to kind of tackle, or have you considered and pondered ways to be able to discuss alternative methods of managing pine plantations to increase diversity throughout the southeast?
Sure. So, fortunately, we're in a good place on that right now. What people have learned over time, as learning goes, right? Mm-hmm. It always takes a while. The initial, you know, super intense pine plantation, you know, pack as many trees in as possible, has slowly moved out of that into we understand the importance of open overstory so that we get early successional vegetation on the ground in about any plantation. We understand that we need to rotate our ages, so we're not just all one age class all the time, and we need to use smaller plots. And the forestry industry has been very proactive in that.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases. Now, there is some legacy impacts on not wanting to burn in pine plantations because it's dangerous in some cases, right? I mean, you can, you know, herbicide works better in those particular situations. They can go in and spray herbicide and keep the understory down. You're in the south, you know, you get lots of sweet gum regeneration. You got some yaupon and, you know, that kind of stuff. So there is some stuff to work there. But the good news is that moving forward, we're starting to see shifts in forestry as a whole towards bringing back longleaf.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Bringing back fire on the landscape as part of a management regime. And I'm not saying that they weren't there, but we're starting to see these transitions from loblolly pine plantations to mixed loblolly longleaf plantations that are providing more available vegetation. And they're seeing, in some cases, the same financial benefit from that. You know, we're starting to see our ability to thin at different rates at different times in our loblolly plantations to keep a little bit more open canopy, maybe use smaller plot sizes whenever we're planting. And there's some benefit to that. You know, the fortunate thing is there's no bus to throw anybody under, right? I mean, we're all pulling the same way. And forestry industry partners are a great partner because if you think about that, they're some of the few places where you still have significant contiguous landholdings.
Yes.
Right? And those significant contiguous landholdings in some cases remain the only unfragmented vegetation communities on the landscape. In some regions and some states. They're the blocks of timber that you still have. So as we move forward and everything advances, forestry energy partners have been, you know, very proactive and slowly becoming more proactive. But we all work slowly. Progress, change is slow. Progress is slow.
Yep.
But we'll get there.
Absolutely.
So overall, you feel very upbeat about the direction of land management?
Yes, I am upbeat about land management in general. I think that education is key.
Yeah.
I think that, regretfully, I think that social media has about as much of a negative impact sometimes as a positive impact because you get a lot of divergent views on how individuals should manage their land. And regretfully, not all of them are informed.
Yeah.
But from a broad scale, we're moving in the right direction. I think the National Wild Turkey Federation has done a good job engaging with industry and federal and state partners to address some of these things. I think that, you know, you've got a lot of other agencies that are pulling the same way. NRCS, USDA as a kind of a overbody, Northern Bobwhite Conservationist, NBCI, is pulling the same way. The Ruffed Grouse Society is pulling the same way. So there's a lot of people working on the same topics. And, you know, the umbrella for everybody, the umbrella is what we need to do is create sustainable, diverse forests that are recreationally and economically beneficial spread across the landscape. And that's kind of what everybody's goal is. And I think that it comes down to the ability to actively manage on the ground. So I'm very upbeat and positive about where we're going from a land management perspective. The trick is, how do we take all these land management actions and ensure that they're having the right effect on the right species at the right time? And, sure. And that's what scientists like myself are trying to work on, especially with turkeys.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, we can't thank you enough for coming by.
Definitely.
Man, it was a great talk. Keep up the great work. It's very awesome and encouraging to see people like yourself passing out great information that we can all as landowners take out and implement.
So. Yeah, I'm glad to help, and I'm sure at some point you guys will see something else that's interesting and give me a call, and we can absolutely do this again.
Matt doesn't know this, but you and I had a great chat about what you've got going on at LSU about taking college age or that 20 to 23.
Yes.
Yeah, he's been doing some awesome stuff. So we'll talk
recruiting hunters?
Recruiting new hunters,
Recruiting, I'll give you the short version.
Let's hear the
little plug is that everyone knows that that hunter numbers are down have been long-term decline. And most R3 programs, most recruitment programs focus on kids, right? Take a kid to hunt. You have women in the outdoors and all those kind of things. But most of the effort goes to let's take a 13-year-old out on their first deer hunt or whatnot.
Right.
LSU, myself and several colleagues have a little different of a model in that we are – actively working on recruiting hunters that have never hunted before that are natural resource students. And we did about 65 hunts last year of new hunters, primarily urban and suburban. About 80% of the hunters are female, primarily urban and suburban students. And the beauty of it is that our retention rates are in the 50 to 75%.
That's fantastic.
Because these are people that have cars and have jobs and are graduating college and have money. Yes. And we
love
being outside already. Yep. So what's nice and what's cool about it is that it's expanded to where the success we've had at LSU, and then there's another equivalent one at University of California, Davis, has now expanded to where a great number of universities are starting this. And several of the organizations here have been quietly sponsoring, and I won't name any of them now, we'll do that another day, but quietly sponsoring us because, you know, it's expensive to take a person hunting on a faculty member's salary. You know, try explaining to your wife you got to do 67 hunts this year. We can certainly come back and talk about that, and it's a really cool story, and there's a lot to talk about there.
I'd love to hear that.
Awesome. For sure. Well, thank
appreciate
you so
your time,
much
sir.
No, great, it was great to see you guys, and I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely.